Thanks for listening to A Little More Conversation. I'm Ben O'Hara Byrne. Tonight, he was one of the few observers to correctly predict that Vladimir Putin would indeed invade Ukraine in early 2022. Now, Dmitry Alperovich has turned his attention to what is the most important and potentially dangerous major power rivalry in the world right now in a new book called World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. And he's with me to look into where he sees the threats and the solutions. How concerned should we be about the ongoing spread of H5N1 or avian flu in U.S. dairy cattle herds? It's been more than a month now since the first case was reported. It could be many months since the first case was actually contracted, and it appears to have spread quickly. So what threat does it pose to us as consumers? And while no cases have been detected yet in this country, are we ready? Don't slouch. How many times have you heard that over the years? Where does it come from? And why do we associate good posture with not only better health, but even better character, morality? The author of a new book called Slouch sets us straight about what's fact and what's fiction behind it all. But first, the leader of the official opposition got booted from the House of Commons today during question period after using unparliamentary language and refusing to retract it. Pierre Poilievre claims he's being silenced, but the party was quickly fundraising off the whole affair today. So as Parliament just turned into yet another forum for grandstanding meant to go direct to social media. And what does that say about the state of political discourse in 2024? We talked to someone who is there today to witness the whole thing. Well, today was one of those days you might have wanted to have been there, because it was a very testy day in the House of Commons during question period today. We know it's been a while now since things between the governing Liberals and the opposition Conservatives have been pretty tetchy, but they got a little bit out of control today. And I'll set the tone for you here. A Conservative leader, Pierre Poilievre, was attacking the Liberals over BC's request to end certain aspects of a pilot project that allows for the decriminalization of the possession of small amounts of hard drugs. It's been in place in BC for well over a year now. There's been quite a bit of controversy around it. And now BC is sort of asking for certain parts of it to be changed, and that's sort of ongoing. But the Conservatives have jumped on this as a way to attack the Liberals for what they think are unreasonable drug policies. But it got... well, they didn't use the word unreasonable today. Have a listen.
He continues to allow those drugs to kill the people in our hospitals and on our public transit. When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko prime minister?
No, no, no. I'm going to ask the honourable leader of the opposition to withdraw that term, which is not considered parliamentary.
Mr. Speaker, I replace wacko with extremist. He is an extremist.
The honourable member to please.
That goes on for a little bit here. The other voice you're hearing there is the Speaker of the House, Greg Fergus, who gives him opportunities, Poilievre, to retract the statement. He instead offers to use a different term instead, extremist than radical. So eventually, Fergus asks him to leave for disregarding the authority of the chair. I don't think I've ever seen an opposition leader be kicked out of the House of Commons, but he was today. Soon, the whole Conservative caucus followed him out the door in protest. Now, Poilievre claims he was being censored when he was ejected. Afterwards, Liberal Immigration Minister Mark Miller said that's just not the case.
Who silences him? He keeps saying dumb things. I think it would be good if he shut up. He shut his yap once in a while. But the stuff that he does in the House of Commons is disgraceful.
Right. So you can see where this is all going, right? The Conservatives say the word wacko has been used in the House many times, though being considered unparliamentary language. Of course, in the past, it's never been used to refer to someone directly, as was the case here. But making that case is Conservative MP Michael Barrett.
The leader of the official opposition raised the issue of this wacko policy and was ejected by the Liberal speaker for calling it exactly what it is.
First of all, just to clarify things, he's not the Liberal speaker. He is the Speaker of the House, right? So already we're playing a little bit fast and loose with the rules. And, you know, wacko has been used in the past. And you can tell, I mean, Conservatives are using the word wacko today like a toddler who's just discovered a swear word. They've been using it all the time. So I don't think it was particularly unintentional that this came out today. But he did refer to the Prime Minister as wacko, which is slightly different. One of the few reporters who was in the room to witness this is Dale Smith. He's a freelance journalist in the Parliamentary Press Gallery. He's author of The Unbroken Machine. Dale, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, I always think of a Tuesday in late April in the House of Commons for QP question period as probably being, you could probably expect a pretty tame affair, but not today. What was it like? I mean, there's a backstory here. This sort of started off badly and just went downhill from there.
Yeah, I mean, it started off by the second question, things were getting out of hand. First question is always in French. Poilievre asked the BC question. Trudeau responds, you know, we're looking to, you know, deal with the situation with compassion and science and healthcare, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then Poilievre switches to English to ask the same thing. And this time Trudeau says, I've already answered that, but when are you going to answer for meeting with white supremacists and members of Diaglon? And a huge eruption happened at that point, and certain conservatives started screaming at the speaker. And one of them was Lethbridge MP Rachel Thomas, and the speaker called her out directly for it. And her response was, I have a big problem with the chair. And when she did not retract that, she got ejected first.
Wow.
And then it went back another few rounds of Poilievre and Trudeau going on about the drug policy, and Trudeau going on about the meeting with these members in this encampment, some of whom were extremists. And, you know, kept giving Poilievre this notion about, you know, you need to disavow, you need to disavow.
Right. So they're talking past each other at this point. Yeah. They're not even talking about the same issue.
Until,
right.
When he didn't, Trudeau referred to him as being spineless in his, in his not condemning them. And that also caused an eruption, and the speaker had the prime minister restate that. And then we closed off with, the clip we heard with the wacko comment. Poilievre, when he was ejected, he started walking out, got a huge applause from his side of the bench. And then most of the conservatives started following him out, but there was a few that remained, and it looked to me like these were the ones who were already on the speaking list, and they were going to stick in the chamber and still carry on with their questions while everyone else left. But Trudeau still hadn't given his answer to that question that that Poilievre had asked before he got ejected. And so he again went on about, you know, not denouncing Diaglon and Alex Jones, at which point Michael Barrett started screaming at Trudeau that Hamas had endorsed him.
Dale, it's painful. I'll be honest with you. It's painful to listen to it because it's so juvenile and so ridiculous. I mean, you've sat through a lot of QP.
To warn Barrett. And then at that point, all the rest of the conservatives left. And the rest of QP was quiet. It was peaceful. It was just a complete 180 from everything that had just happened.
So, I mean, you've watched a lot of question period over the years, I know. What's going on here? Because the sense that I get is that this is just all for social media. Like, none of it's even about debating these policies. Listen, you know, the decriminalization policy in BC is worth talking about. It's worth debating about rashly, but it's not, you know, the Liberals didn't impose it. It's a provincial thing. And it's not really, I mean, I live in BC. It's not the root cause of the opioid crisis in any way, shape, or form. So it seems to me that, and then we've seen the word wacko being thrown around all over the place. I don't want to only pinpoint the conservatives here because unruly behavior in the House has become pretty common, but it feels like it's just all performance for social media.
That's 100% what it is. Ever since the advent of clipping video for social media, that is all Parliament has become, largely in question period, but also now that's spread to committees as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, committees used to be where all the real work happened. And now it's just dog and pony shows where they are trying to get their clips for their socials and talking about how outrageous whatever they set up for the day that they were denied was. And it's just a constant cycle of social media clips. And the government is just as guilty of doing this as well.
Indeed.
Their own responses are 75% of the time non sequiturs to the questions that were being asked. And it's, you know, just the kind of happy, clappy, pablum talking point that they want to push out. And so you've got two sides just talking past one another, all for the sake of getting the clip that they want.
Yeah. How do you think the speaker handled this? Because I've seen different people say, well, listen, he offered to change the word and maybe he should have just left it at that and just let it continue. What did you make of that?
I think he needed to put his foot down at some point. The conservatives have been testing him and trying to undermine his authority in other ways. And eventually something needs to break. I don't think that offering to replace the word was actually sufficient because the speaker had asked him to withdraw. And if the speaker asks you to withdraw the comment, you withdraw the comment. You don't try and wheedle around it. And that was what this is really about. It was he was undermining the authority of the chair in trying to prevaricate and you know, still try and find ways to avoid doing the actual withdrawing or not even apologizing. Right. And I think that's what this, you know, this really boiled down to was he was essentially undermining the chair, and you can't really have that.
No, I mean, in this sense, I mean, the conservatives point out that the term has been used before, and I think different reporters have gone out and sort of found examples of people using the term wacko in the House, but never in reference to a person. It's always been used
exactly.
In reference to a policy. And in this case, it was the policy and the person. I think that was where the unparliamentary language aspect of this came in.
Yeah, that was exactly it. You know, previous examples were not directed toward a person. And that's exactly what the speaker was referring to.
Continues to allow those drugs to kill the people in our hospitals and on our public transit. When will we put an end to this wacko policy by this wacko Prime Minister?
No, no, no. I'm going to ask the Honourable Leader of the Opposition to withdraw that term, which is not considered parliamentary.
Mr. Speaker, I replace wacko with extremist. He is an extremist.
The Honourable Member to please...
Oh, there you have it. Dale Smith is with us this half hour from Ottawa, freelance journalist in the Parliamentary Press Gallery. We're talking about that exchange today between Pierre Poilievre and the Speaker of the House, Greg Fergus, for which Poilievre was ejected, kicked out of the game, so to speak, given a game of strong conduct for bad behavior, unparliamentary language, to be clear. So, Dale, I mean, where do we go from here? Because it feels like, you know, we're not on the cusp of an election just yet. And it feels like, you know, QP and just the whole kind of conversation has degraded itself now into something like this. And it's, I don't know, as an outsider, you watch it, you just think we pay these people a lot of money to represent us. And we kind of want them dealing with our problems, not bickering like a bunch of high school students.
Yeah. And as someone who's there every day, I feel just as disheartened because when I started on the Hill 15 years ago, the debate was actual debate on more often than not. And now it's sound bites for social media.
Yeah. I mean, I think the broader thing, I mean, you're seeing it all the time, right? What's your sense of where this came from? Because all of a sudden, every conservative MP on social media was using the term. I feel like they're going to print T-shirts of it, too. I mean, does this count as a win? Now, like today, because they dominated the conversation, we're talking about it tonight, people are using the term. Does this count as a win now for the opposition on a day like today?
It might, depending on how much fundraising money this brings in.
Right. I saw that letter went out really. That letter went out fast today about him getting kicked out.
Yeah, and that's what a lot of this stuff is. And this isn't the first time they've done coordinated campaigns like this. They've had previous instances where, for certain votes that were upcoming, they would single out individual MPs, and each conservative who stood up would single out another one that they were designated to single out, and then they would all gather their clips of singling out those MPs and blasting them over social media to try and shame them into voting for whatever conservative motion it was of the day. But these kinds of coordinated campaigns and using question period as the stage by which you gather your materials for these coordinated campaigns is becoming more and more common.
Yeah, it was interesting to see the liberals puffed up with righteous indignation too, because I watch enough QP to know they're just as guilty, maybe in a slightly different way, but they do exactly the same thing to some extent. They're in government, so it's a bit different, but you know, they're as guilty at times as everyone else.
Oh, 100%. And what was actually really curious today is normally when someone gets ejected from the House, they march right up to the foyer to the camera station there and, you know, cry to the media about how hard done by they've been. The conservatives didn't do that today. They avoided the media with one or two exceptions and then did this entirely over social media. And it was the Liberals. And there was like two or three ministers who all lined up at the microphone after QP to each give their own denunciation of what happened today. And it was interesting to see that it was the government who was using the, you know, the microphone and the camera in the foyer for this purpose after conservatives got kicked out and not the conservatives themselves.
Yeah. Well, to be continued, I guess they're all back at it tomorrow. Dale, thank you so much.
And tomorrow's going to be super interesting because Trudeau is slated to answer all of the questions tomorrow. So it could make an even more interesting day tomorrow.
Oh, my. Dale, well, good luck. I'll be watching you on social media. Thanks so much.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You want to see how you really look, Adrielline? This is it. Your head pokes forward. Your shoulders slump, your stomach. Well, take a look.
Yes, Adrielline, the mirror may have gone crazy, but for the first time, it's telling you the truth. Like a lot of boys and girls, your posture is your problem. What are you going to do about it?
I'll tell you what I'm going to do about it. I'm going to make you reflect what I want to see, because I'm going to have good posture. You just wait and see.
Yeah, Adrielline, I haven't heard that name in a long time. That is an educational film, obviously made back in the 1950s, about posture. And if you think about posture, probably sometime when you were young, certainly in my case, someone told you to sit up straight. Someone told you to stand up straight. Someone told you that if you were slouching, it was bad. We had those messages hammered into us at some point, maybe not quite in those terms, which was a bit much, by the way. Adrielline starts off at a party where no one will talk to her. So, you know, you get, not only is it bad for your health, but it's a social stigma as well, right? They sort of hammer all those things in. In short, bad posture was considered a sign of decay, right? In the 20th century, it just was. Maybe a little so less so now, but we still, when you think about posture, I think a lot of those things still run through your mind, right? But that was no accident back when. A century ago, posture exams were the norm in places like schools and workplaces, the military, obviously. That was in part thanks to something called the American Posture League, which was sort of created by doctors and others about 100 years ago now, a little bit more. And from that, an entire industry would emerge to improve posture, not just classes and videos like that one, but products as well. You can think of them. But why? Because science doesn't really support any of it. And what is correct posture anyway? You'd think it'd be as varied as the number of body shapes and sizes that there are out there, right? And that's the thrust of a new book by science and medical historian Beth Linker, who's at the University of Pennsylvania. Her book is called Slouch, which is a great name, Posture Panic in Modern America. And she joins me now. Beth, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, Ben.
There's been, I was just curious as to your reaction to this. I don't think that I was taken right away by the whole presentation of it, the title. It's very intriguing, but wow, what a reaction to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's because, well, first of all, it's not something that everybody talks about, but I think we all have our own kind of posture stories, and we probably walk around to some degree thinking about our posture. So why, you know, I think for me, it became a question of why is it that every time I tell people I'm writing a book called Slouch, they start to get all uncomfortable and sit up straight and say, you know, think that I'm assessing them or evaluating them, or that I'm necessarily writing a self-help book.
Right. Maybe part of it is that when I thought back to when I was first told about posture, it's sort of ingrained in us when we're really young. You sort of think back to those. It's like doing your ABCs in some way. So it has all this history, this personal history for almost all of us, I would think.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, I mean, there still are scoliosis exams. I don't know what the state of it is in Canada. I believe they still happen there. Maybe it's by location and school district. But in the United States, fair number of states still do scoliosis exams. So I do think that it's, we just have this in our grand, whether it's grandparents, aunts, uncles, somebody in your family has said to you, you should really sit up straight. You should
Yeah.
really stand up straight.
I've heard you say that you had this book in mind for a while. It was just a question of sort of focusing it, narrowing it down, finding the right narrative for it. How did you come up with it? How did you decide, okay, this is what Slouch is going to be about?
Yeah, I mean, when I figured out that I wanted to do a book on posture, it seemed a little unwieldy. When I started doing the research, if you just do even a Google Ngram on it, I mean, they're just, it's in so many places. It's in literature, it's symbolic, it's metaphorical. In film, in literature, you often have, so the Hunchback of Notre Dame, King Henry VIII, you have all of these figures who are either slumped or slouched or even flat feet, like a flat footed. I think it was a slur in the United States to call New York City police force like flat footed cops. So it got, whenever I started down the road of researching this, it was a little overwhelming. So I had to keep coming back to what was my question and what was my area of expertise. And my area of expertise is history of science and history of medicine. And I knew that somewhere along the way, it probably became medicalized.
Right, this idea that that somehow it was, I mean, it's in reading through the book, there's so much to it, there's so much history to it, but what really struck me was there doesn't seem to be any real medical justification for it. I mean, we could talk about
Yes.
back pain and so on, but it's sort of built on a, you know, it's sort of erected on a bed of we don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, in the late 19th century and early 20th century, for physicians and physical educators to say, well, I think good posture will prevent a lot of infectious disease, it will prevent back pain. I don't think that's necessarily a for them at that time a bad thing. I think the alternative was at this time period in the early 20th century, it was really the time of heroic surgery because we didn't really have antibiotics until the 1940s and really good kind of pharmaceutical care. And in the early 20th century, this is when you had anesthesia and asepsis techniques that had been discovered in the 19th century. And you'll see, like in tuberculosis, for example, there is the rest cure, but there are also things like rib resections and people who had what was thought to be like sagging kidneys or organs. Surgeons, abdominal surgeons, were going in and lifting them and putting them into place. And so my posture people at least are not recommending that, right? Like they're just
Right.
saying, can you just please stand up and, you know, I'm going to train you how to stand and sit straight. And so it's kind of a way, it's kind of a holistic health viewpoint viewed in a certain way. And the
Right.
other thing is that there weren't the same scientific standards then as there is now. Most journal articles for professional physicians and healthcare workers, most articles were case studies. There wasn't, you know, evidence-based medicine and large groups of people and elaborate statistics.
Right.
Go ahead.
There's nothing wrong with sort of promoting good posture, ultimately. I think where it got strange, and you touch on this obviously, is when it crossed over into sort of the moral, into the character, into, you know, to slouch was a sign of bad character, a sign of poor morality. That's when it starts to cross over into other areas.
Right. Yeah. I think it's it crosses over because those posture scientists who I talk about in the early 20th century were also part of the eugenics movement. And as I'd like to point out, they weren't part of the hard eugenics movement, that is, the people who wanted to endorse sterilization for quote unquote unfit people. So they were not hard eugenicists, but they did believe in a kind of soft eugenics. Which would be, you know, physical education and fitness in order to improve the race. And it was, as I argue, inherently ableist. And I still think today, when you hear people barking the command to stand or sit straight, what always comes to mind when I hear that or witness that is, well, first of all, can the person even do that? Do they have some kind of inherent disability or musculoskeletal problem that precludes them from doing that? And the second question I have when people, you know, ask that or demand that is why? And third, I guess I have three questions. Third would be, for how long do you think I can sustain the upright posture or sitting? Is someone going to like say, do it again at 5 minutes when you switch positions like we all naturally do?
Yeah. And also, what is good posture? I mean, what is the definition of good posture? I mean, I think we recognize it when we see it because it's been so ingrained in us. But there isn't really a definition for something that's meant to be somewhat scientific. There isn't really a definition of what exactly it means.
Yeah. And that's because, I mean, if you think about it, the sheer variety of human anatomy, it becomes really difficult. And what one person's good posture might be, like what might be good for you might not be great for another person. And then the other problem with people who do exaggerated good postures or are constantly thinking about their good posture, they can have injuries themselves as well. So the command can actually, if someone were to be raised in a very strict household with somebody who was always a posture crusader as a caregiver, that person could have injuries themselves.
Beth Linker is with us this half hour. Her book is called Slouch: Posture Panic in Modern America. Just to sort of unpick the title a little bit, I mean, the word panic suggests that there was a time on this continent and elsewhere where good posture was seen as sort of primordial, that having bad posture might prevent you from getting a good job. It was a reflection on your character and so on and so forth. When you looked at sort of how that panic has evolved into the 21st century, what did you come up with? Where are we at? I feel like just reading it, I still hold on to a lot of some of these prejudices that you talk about.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know if there is the same kind of panic. I mean, if I can get a little academic, just briefly.
Sure.
Michel Foucault is famous for arguing that, you know, in the modern era, so say like 19th century, you can see regimens of control very clearly, right? You can see militarism, you can see even a posture crusader who makes you stand for a nude posture photo, or, you know, if those who went to Catholic school, a nun kind of like hitting you with a ruler,
right?
And that no longer happens, right? And so Foucault would say, oh, that makes perfect sense, because what happens is you could see these forms of discipline and regimen and control, but then they slowly, what happens is you have surveillance that you can see, and then it becomes embodied. It becomes self-surveillance. And he argues that that is more pernicious in a way, because we can't see it. So I think, I don't know if we could say that it is as much panic now. It's hard to address that, because if it is so embedded in our own thinking and we do all kinds of self-surveillance, it's hard to measure and see the degree to which the fear or anxiety is, like how severe is it?
That would explain a lot of the reaction to your book and the interest in your book too, right? Because people are sort of grappling with their own thoughts about this very common thing that we kind of ask ourselves, like, oh, I need to sit up. I need to sit up. We do it all the time. You mentioned the photos, and that's a really interesting part of your book, because I don't know if many people know that history, that photos were taken of students at schools, elite schools in the US, naked photos to sort of monitor their posture. And I thought that was, and that wasn't that long ago. That was in the 60s, right? It just seemed absolutely, that blew my mind, I have to be honest.
Yeah. So in the United States, at least, most universities were run under the assumption that it was in loco parentis. That means in place of the parent. So universities and colleges could do pretty much anything they wanted to do, because they were essentially the parent of the students. And the students were not recognized as adults.
Right.
With any kind of privileges of autonomy or privacy. So yes, physical educators and physicians would have entering students into many, many universities and colleges at all different levels would take nude or near nude posture photos of entering students, then the students would receive a grade of an A, B, C, or D. And then the students would be tracked or placed into remedial phys ed or, you know, other kinds of physical education courses. And oftentimes a student needed to get an A grade posture before they could do something like athletics. And then also these schools would have classes, right? Posture classes, fundamentals of movement class, which was a popular title for these classes. The culture of nudity, I mean, at Yale, the Yale men were had to swim in the nude. I mean, a lot of their gym classes were in the nude.
Really?
And there was this woman, she was from Germany, but really kind of caused quite a stir. She was featured in Life magazine. Bess Mezendieck, I think that's it. I've never had to pronounce her name.
Right.
But she held classes with students in the nude.
I had no idea. That wouldn't go over so
with
well.
With mirrors.
And this was a lot of this was around posture, was around sort of
getting
your body shape correct.
Yes, yes. Because there really was, it became linked in the early 20th century in the eugenic era. And in this era, that's post-germ theory and pre-antibiotics, there was a pretty strong effort to link posture with disease and to have posture serve as a preventative health measure of disease.
Wow. What would you like? I mean, anytime someone finishes a book, it kind of takes on a life of its own, as I'm sure you're becoming acutely aware of right now.
Yes.
But what did you ultimately want people to walk away with? I mean, this is sort of in some ways, it's a cautionary tale about many things. Yeah. But what were you hoping that readers would sort of walk away from this knowing?
Yeah. I'd like to just have, you know, I think it offers some pause with these epidemics, such as like the obesity epidemic. I'd like readers to think again about when we think we know what a bodily norm is. And I think also as a historian and as a historian of science, if anybody can come away from this with a greater understanding of the cultural and the political and the social kind of ideas that get
right. The conformity to some extent
embedded
right?
into yeah. our health beliefs and also even into scientific beliefs. Like that to me would be a win.
You know, I getting into it, I just had no idea how thought provoking it would be. So Beth, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
What have you done about grocery prices? I mean, I tried to adapt pretty quickly. You know, I mean, the price of sort of our every second or third day shop went up pretty drastically a couple of years back. So we just started buying things on sale. I mean, that's pretty much how we managed to kind of fight it, is just try to buy things that were on sale and then buy things that you use a lot on sale. You know, things like olive oil, which has just gone through the roof of late, is one of those things that if I see it on sale, I just buy it. Doesn't matter if we run out or not, which is hardly, you know, hardly science. It's just one of those things that we've had to adapt to. You know, there was a time where I think everyone was a little more carefree probably with their grocery shopping than they are today. If you go online, specifically on places like Reddit, where people share comments and so on, you can find an awful lot of people not only giving each other advice about groceries, but also just venting about their anger over the profits that grocery stores are making, the lack of competition in this country to them, and what seems like a sudden realization that as much as prices went up over the past few years, and although that stabilized a little bit, you know, they're never coming back down. I mean, I think we've all started to realize that, you know, if you think butter at $8.99 seems a bit ridiculous, well, I think that's where it's going to stay, unfortunately. And so online, there's been a group, a very successful one, started by a woman named Emily Johnson in Milton, Ontario, that pretty much became like a forum for venting about major grocers and about rising food prices and their profits and all of it with a specific aim. I mean, Loblaw seems to get most of the flack here, perhaps unsurprisingly, considering she's in Ontario. But there are now people all over the country, but 56,000 now. And what they've come up with is an idea in the month of May to boycott Loblaw, just to spend their grocery money elsewhere. I'll have Emily Johnson. She spoke to Global News recently. Here's how she explains it.
The hope is that we can be, you know, taking steps to reduce grocery prices. Whether you think that you can avoid local stores or not, there are plenty of ways for you to get involved and, you know, to ensure that your voice is heard, because you're not alone in any of these struggles.
Indeed. So it's bigger than this. I mean, I think Loblaw has become a convenient target here. They're not the only grocery store out there, but they have become quite the target through all of this. The primary aim of the boycott is to have a financial impact on the company, the biggest of the Canadian grocers. But she also hopes the boycott educates people and gets the attention of government. And they have some demands. They want Loblaw to sign the Grocery Code of Conduct, as well as others. And they want them to commit to affordable pricing. Monica LaBarge is an adjunct assistant professor at Queen's University, and she studies food access and consumer well-being, and she's been paying close attention to how consumers have been reacting to the rise in grocery prices of late and how companies have been responding to their customers. Monica, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
This has been interesting. What I found really interesting about this was how organic it was, and how, because people have been sort of complaining about groceries in general, Loblaw specifically, for quite a while now, and suddenly this just kind of ballooned, snowballed, to use a bit more Canadian term, of late. What do you make of it?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, boycotts have obviously been around for a long time, but they used to be, or generally are employed in sort of niche fields. So, you know, environmentalism, you know, labor practices. If you think about like Nike boycott, the boycotts of Nike for child labor, also sort of geopolitical things. So boycotting Russian companies over the conflict in Ukraine. And now we are seeing that with Israeli companies as well. Mm-hmm. So this sort of wider spread, you know, across a whole, you know, industry, I guess, that's quite broad, right? Is relatively new. But I think part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, all those boycotts I, you know, talked about in the past, like the PETA and Nike, those were a lot of work to organize. And so you had to be pretty committed to be an activist, to be participating in those and to organize those. Social media has made, you know, democratized access to boycotts and protests. And I think we've seen over the past, you know, 5 years, right? Like if you talk about Black Lives Matter and Idle No More and, you know, all mm-hmm. kinds of protests, I think we have all become a little bit more emboldened to be able to speak up and say, we're not happy with this, instead of it's just business as usual and there's nothing I can do about it. So regardless of how successful this particular boycott is, I think we're going to see more of this kind of thing that does grow organically, because it is so easy to share these kinds of things on social media in a way that it wouldn't have been in the past.
What's interesting about this one, too, is that it seems to be a pretty big tent. I mean, a lot of the ones you've been talking about, sort of, you need to have a fair amount of knowledge of a certain issue often, right? But in this one, it seems to have cast a really wide net and grabbed a lot of people in it who are angry about one thing that crosses many political, social boundaries, to put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all share, as human beings, we all share a visceral understanding of what it's like to be able to access and not to be able to access food. And what does hunger mean on some level, right? Fortunately, a lot of us we don't wake up every morning with that deep aching hunger, but there mm-hmm. are a lot of Canadians and an increasing number of Canadians who do. And, you know, fundamentally, when we talk about food insecurity, it's not an abstract concept. People become food insecure because either they can't access the food and it's too far away, or because they can't afford the food that is in the stores that are around them. And so as these prices go up and up, if you think about people's ability to afford food as a distribution, more and more of that distribution is being carved off as people who now can't afford to access the food they need to not be hungry.
It's interesting in the case of this one that this has been going on for quite some time. I mean, food inflation, if anything, is kind of stabilizing a little bit now. And yet you see this sort of residual anger. And I guess part of it is that we all grocery shop all the time. So we're incredibly sensitive to price changes there. And I think we've all come to the realization that while prices may have stabilized a little bit, they're not going back to where they once were. And I feel like that's fueling some more consumer unhappiness these days as well.
I absolutely 100% agree with you in that grocery prices and food prices are so salient to us because we buy it so often, right? And even though you might not have noticed it, you know, as you were going to the store every week, if you weren't really closely looking at your budget, at some point you're going to look at the butter and be like, How is this $8.99 now? I could have sworn I used to pay $4.75,
Indeed.
and it'll catch up to you, right? Yeah, I mean, I think that we've all become really sensitive to it, but you're right. Once prices go up, they don't tend to come back down. And so I think one of the things that Loblaws and all the grocers really need to do is look at their price structure and say, how much have we built in here that we've been raising the prices because we can versus raising the prices because we have to? Because there are stores, like I was buying something online at IKEA the other day, and they very clearly are saying, we've cut our prices, and they showed you what the old price was and they show you what the new price was. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, how were they able to do that if inflation is going up and cost of goods are going up? But apparently they are able to. And so then that begs the question, why can't some of these other companies doing something similar?
Why do you think, I mean, I think I know inherently, but why is it, do you think, that so much of the anger over food prices has been targeted at the grocers themselves? Because if you listen to lots of people talk about it, they try to explain how complex the whole supply chain is, how grocery margins are not that high. And yet, that's where a lot of our anger has been targeted, specifically in this case, at Loblaw.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. There is a lot of complexity, and you can get really inside baseball in some of these topics. And when we talk about slotting fees and marketing co-op expenses and things like that, which are built into the whole process, we also obviously have some, sectors where there's some subsidization of crops and of production. But I think there's a couple of things. I think grocers in general have become the target because they're the last mile, and they're the ones who we're actually paying our money to, right? Like,
Right.
they're the face of the prices. I think also there is some, we've come to the conclusion, not wrongly, that there is some flexibility on prices, right? And to take Loblaws, for example, when we talk about the bread price fixing scandal,
Right.
that introduced the idea that prices are not this like set in the ether and come down to us from on high, that people are making decisions about what those prices are. And again, with the internet, we're able to price compare between grocery stores and other stores and look at the same box of crackers that's being sold for multiple different prices. So even for people who are not, students of business or pricing or marketing, you go, well, wait a minute, how is the same thing multiple different prices? And so that makes you think, well, somebody's making the choice to set it at X. And I'd like them to set it at Y, which is lower than X. So I think we're all becoming a little bit more savvy. The internet has helped us price compare without having to drive all over, the city trying to figure out where you can buy something. And so I think all of those different things together have made grocers the target.
Monica LaBarge is with us this half hour. She is a professor, an adjunct assistant professor at Queen's University in Kingston, who studies food access and consumer well-being. We're talking about a move afoot to boycott Loblaw in May. It started off pretty small on Reddit, then grew, ballooned. It's up to tens of thousands of people last time I looked. And the call is essentially to send Loblaw a message that the people aren't happy with their big profits and the pricing, regardless of all the intricacies of how that is said to work. Monica, what have you made of the reaction so far? I mean, I guess we can talk about Loblaw specifically here. They have sort of buckled somewhat to public pressure in the past few months when they decided to reduce their sort of need to sell by stuff from 50% to 30%. They seem to have reversed that to a great extent. What have you made of the reaction to this? Because it's never the headlines you want to see if you're a company.
No, I mean, I think hopefully they're starting to get the message. I think one issue with Loblaw that I would, if I was the marketing consultant working with them, that I would talk to them about is the need to do some primary research on your customers who are not your core customers, right? Because they are getting now a lot of data about their core customers from their loyalty program, PC Optimum,
Right.
and that was really one of the reasons why they bought Shoppers to begin with, was because of the strength of that program and the amount of data they can get from that. But That kind of data only tells you what is happening. It doesn't tell you why. And, you know, I often say that loyalty programs, when we talk about grocery stores and gas stations and things like that, they're not really like, we're not really loyal to these companies. It mostly has to do with habit. And sure, if you're going to offer me something free for shopping with you within in exchanging some of my data that I may or may not accurately value, that you know, I'll do that, right? But if you're only relying on that analytics data and not actually going out and talking to people and listening to the pain that they feel at the checkout, then I think you're missing some of the nuance that is driving this emotional reaction and this desire to sort of lash out and to try and exert some power, which is really what's at the heart of these boycotts.
It's interesting you say that they actually know a lot more about their customers than they ever have before. But it mightn't be telling them the whole story. You might still be buying the same products. You're not just not doing it with any sense of happiness.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and I think fundamentally, like you said, we've got tens of thousands of people in this Reddit group. What that means in terms of a financial impact for Loblaws is still to be seen. I guess that'll be an interesting case study. But to me, I think the real risk for Loblaws is not people not shopping there for May. I think the risk is the slow erosion of its brand image that it's built up over many years, right? That it wants to be seen as a positive company, a positive force in the community, et cetera. But this drip, drip, drip of negative feeling and negative news about it is eroding that. And they need to do something meaningful and visible to try and counteract that instead of these sort of unforced errors, I've been calling them, right? Like, we're going to reduce this discount for people who are the most vulnerable. I mean, who wants to buy things that are near expiry? Just about nobody, but you're doing it because you can't afford it otherwise, right? And so I think some of these errors are making because they're not paying attention to the right stakeholders. I think that's really what's driving some of this negative press.
It's interesting that in some senses, because they did fly on the radar for so long in terms of their kind of social consciousness, that in some ways we expected, I think people, and this might be an exaggeration, but I don't think I ever thought of other grocery stores quite the way as them because of the way they presented themselves. In some sense, it's come back to bite them. The public expects more of them than perhaps some others.
Yeah. And I think, you know, having a visible spokesperson can be a real boon when everybody likes that person. Ben, I don't know how old you are, but I remember, you know, the initial President's Choice Insider reports, and there was...
Oh yeah, they were great. Those were great.
But, you know, Galen Weston has become, was the face of Loblaws for a long time and, you know, it had a lot going for him when things were going well. But then he also became a lightning rod, right? When you see during the pandemic, when they were cutting that $2 an hour for pay
Major
for
pay.
Pandemic workers. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he was getting a huge bonus, which potentially was contractual based on stock options, et cetera. But it's not a good look. And you should know better, right? That there was a sea change there, I think, in how society was working at the time. And so he's become a visible sign of things that are wrong, right? And the haves and the have-nots. And so I think that's contributed to the problem to a certain extent.
It's interesting too, just I'm wondering how this will play out. Because again, I mean, if you read the Reddit files, there are a lot of people and they're saying, well, you should shop at your independent grocer, you know, forget all of them, right? But in this sense, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, because you don't get the sense that other grocers are jumping in to try to take advantage of this. There's sort of this idea that they are a club, the big ones at least, and they compete, but they don't compete much.
No, I mean, to be totally honest, as a, you know, not a marketer now at this point, but somebody who does really care about food access, consolidation of the grocery industry is a problem in Canada. You know, if we look at other industries that are much more heavily regulated, like telecommunications, we're sort of looking at the same scale here. And grocers have been able to get away for a long time with a lot of that consolidation. But, you know, in big cities like Vancouver, like Ottawa, like Toronto, Montreal, you may have access to independent grocers, or your, you know, local stores. And then, you know, for part of the year in Canada, we could go to farmers markets and things like that, though those often tend to be more expensive. So for people who are really price conscious, that's not really a solution. But there's also a lot of people who are price conscious who live in communities where there is no choice. There is one grocery store. And if you have any mobility challenges or any, time pressure, you're working multiple jobs, you've got kids at home, you can't afford to get in your car if you have one and drive 45 minutes or more to get to another store. And I mean, that's even not even talking about the far north where food has always been insanely expensive, and the options there have been limited to the point of, sort of ridiculousness. So, I think there's a lot that we need to think about in terms of how our food supply is structured, and the call for whether you want to boycott Loblaws or not. I mean, I actually am a pretty frequent Loblaws customer, and I love my PC Optimum points, but diversifying your options within your local food supply is always a good thing. If you think back to the pandemic, it's obvious what happens when global food supplies are compromised. And so supporting CSAs, supporting farmers markets, supporting local grocers is always a good thing, regardless of how you feel about Loblaws, regardless of how you feel about prices. But that diversity, I think, it benefits all of us in a lot of really important ways.
Monica, thank you.
Thanks so much, Ben.
It's been just over a month, really, maybe a little bit more, since we first learned of H5N1 or bird flu being found in dairy cow herds in the US. And there are still a lot of questions out there about what exactly is going on and what risk it could pose to many things, including us. Now, H5N1, you may well know, has been around for decades. I covered it quite extensively when I was based in China about 15 years ago, back in sort of 2008, 2009, and into 2010, 12, etc. But the recent discovery that it has jumped into dairy cattle has been a bit of a game changer. It's infecting cows. I think at last count, it was 34 dairy farms in 9 states. It might have gone up since then. There's only been one mild human infection. But again, I'll let Dr. Dimitri Daskalakis of the U.S. National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases explain briefly.
For most people, if you're not exposed to these animals, the risk is very, very low.
Indeed. But one of the reasons, of course, you may know that H5N1 has been just wreaking havoc with wild birds, that it got into the domestic poultry sort of environment, and it's just been devastating. And one of the issues with cows, of course, is that they're another species that humans have quite a bit of interaction with. So whenever something like H5N1, that kind of a virus, finds a different, say, petri dish, and we'll use that term, it can become quite dangerous. I mean, we don't know, right? I mean, therein lies the issue. We don't know. Someone who knows a lot more than I do is Michael Worabi. He's a professor and the head of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona, but grew up in BC. He joins me now. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, good to be with you then.
I guess just a sort of a state of the union as to where we're at. We talked about it on the show a few months ago, and I guess it was about nine, I think that it was 6 states and a couple of dozen of herds, but it just, I suppose the more they test, the more they find.
Yeah, and what's become clear is this is not an isolated event. It's really all over the U.S. And what I've been doing is looking at the gene sequences of these viruses. And when you have a bunch of these gene sequences, you can make a sort of family tree of them, and you can figure out how quickly the virus evolves and sort of calibrate what we call a molecular clock. And our results tell us that this has been circulating in cattle in the U.S. probably from somewhere between November and early January. So we're already 4 months into this, and the cat is out of the bag.
Yeah, I mean, I heard you quoted in another story saying this was in many ways the biggest news story in the world right now, and I know sometimes people sort of are taken aback by statements like that, but you see there's a seriousness of this. Where does that lie? Is it the unknown of it at this point?
Yeah, there's a few things. So H5N1 is one of these highly pathogenic variants of influenza that we worry about more than some others. influenza viruses are really diverse. And in the bird population around the world, there are multiple different subtypes. H5N1 is one of the concerning ones. And this variant of H5N1 that is spreading around the world has a propensity to jump into mammals that we haven't seen before with H5N1. It's gotten into sea lions and seals in South America, and for the first time shown that it can actually transmit from mammal to mammal rather than each mammalian infection dead end from a bird. And so now with this cattle, not only is it transmitting in mammals, but it's established a beachhead amongst terrestrial mammals that we have close contact with. And I don't want to be alarmist. And I think that the most likely scenario is this isn't going to become a pandemic virus, but it does. This is the kind of scenario that is going to lead to future pandemic influenza, where you have a virus that is able to adapt to mammals and have lots of shots on goal, where it goes from, in this case, cattle to humans, and has that opportunity to evolve within humans the ability to transmit human to human, which is the real obstacle to any flu virus coming, a pandemic virus.
Right. I mean, if I think back to covering this story in China many years ago, I mean, before we'd ever heard of you know, SARS-CoV-2, H5N1 was sort of the one that we often talked about when it came to what might be the next one to really worry about. And it was a topic of conversation it was a story that I covered often. I guess that's it has the building blocks, right? We're always concerned about something having the building blocks to be more serious.
Yeah. And, it's interesting. We don't really have eyes yet on how pathogenic this is in humans, this particular H5N1. But as you'll know, the H5N1 avian to human jumps that have happened mostly in China and Southeast Asia over the last couple of decades have had a really concerningly high mortality rate. My feeling is that this one might not be having that kind of high mortality rate because we're not seeing a lot of uptick in flu-like illness mortality rates. At the same time, this cattle virus is obviously circulating. But again, it's unfortunate that we're still in the early days of trying to figure these things out, even though we're really not in the early days of this virus transmitting in cattle.
Yeah, explain that to me, because I guess for someone who doesn't know this stuff particularly well, if you say December or January, it feels early. But I guess if something's been circulating for, you know, better part of 5 months now or more, that is a long period of time. I mean, it means, as you said, the cat is out of the bag, so we don't really know how far it may have spread. Do we have an idea of how it's spreading?
That's a really good question. It's not pinned down at all yet how it's spreading. What we do know is that this virus can get up to very, very high concentrations in milk and in the udders of lactating cows. And one of the most likely scenarios is that this is it's moving from cow to cow indirectly through the mechanics of milking equipment. You know, one cow goes in, it has a lot of virus in its milk. That virus is now on the machinery, and the next cow goes in and becomes infected. I think that's a very likely scenario. But we're also seeing on farms that have sick cattle, birds, chickens, but also wild birds, blackbirds, grackles, that are coming down with the virus. And clearly it's going it's gone from birds into cattle. It's circulating in cattle, but now it's going back into birds. And so it's possible that it's it's traveling through birds as well. And then the big question is this a respiratory infection as well in cattle? And we don't know the answer to that yet.
It's great to have Michael Warabe with us this half hour. He's a professor and the head of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. We've been talking about H5N1 or avian flu spreading in dairy cattle herds in the U.S. According to Michael, they think it probably originated somewhere back in December, maybe January. So it's been spreading for a while now. We don't really know the scope of it, why or how it's spreading exactly at this point. I guess, Michael, the question a lot of people are asking themselves now, and we haven't really seen it in Canada yet, and I'll get to that in a sec, is just the safety issue around consuming dairy products.
Yeah, and let me actually start by saying when my team and I placed a date on the origin of this, one of the things that I suggested at that point, given that it was maybe, you know, for 4 or more months that this was circulating, was that this had become very prevalent in dairy cattle in the U.S. Colleagues of mine went through 10 states and actually just bought whole milk off the grocery store shelves and right. tested it for traces of viral RNA. And they actually found it in about 40% of the milk samples that they collected. Now, does that mean that there is actual virus in those samples? Absolutely not. And we have very good scientific reasons to think that pasteurization, where milk is heated up to a level that kills off microbes, will inactivate this virus. And all of the research that I've seen so far indicates that that is the case, that I have colleagues who've taken these milk products and attempted to grow virus out of them, and they can't do it. And so I'm not the final word on that, mm-hmm. but I think the more important exposure risk at the moment is to people working on these farms and coming into contact with these cattle and milk.
Right, where we saw that one, my very minor case, I believe, a while back. Tell me a bit about the preparation here, because I gather, you know, again, this is not something that we were entirely unprepared for. I think sometimes we've forgotten just how devastating an impact H5N1 has had on the domestic poultry industry, as well as on wild birds. You mentioned the sea lions down south. I was hearing something about that last week. I mean, this has been a devastating strain of avian flu. But how ready are we? And we haven't seen it in Canada yet, but it doesn't mean, I suggest with the way you've been looking at it, it means it's probably if not, it's probably when, not if, right?
Well, we certainly hope not, but Canada's not a closed system with respect to dairy cattle. And certainly if this is moving from cattle to birds and then birds back to cattle to some degree, then obviously a border means nothing. And so I think, it would be very good if testing was undertaken in Canada, if it's not already, because, you know, the sooner we know about it, the more chance there is of actually limiting the spread. And, you know, perhaps it hasn't made a landing in Canada yet, or if it has, it's in very few locations. But you won't know that unless you look for it. And there are, you know, techniques to look for it that are really powerful.
I suppose then the questions that are left to ask is just how virulent is it? How is it spreading? But what are you going to be looking out for now? Because as you pointed out, I think it's been a month now, a little more than a month since the first case was reported, or at least reported the first that we read about it. As you pointed out, it's been quite a bit longer that it's been circulating. So what now?
Some of the things I'm looking at now and really curious about are if we start getting blood samples from people who work on these dairy farms, are we going to find that a huge proportion of them have antibodies to this H5 variant, which hasn't circulated in humans, and normally you should not find antibodies. And that will indicate that the virus is able to infect people quite readily, even if it may not be able to circulate. The next question is, if you go into the general population that doesn't have any sort of direct exposure, are we going to see this? Similarly, in cattle, what percent of cattle have already been infected in the U.S.? And are we going to see this kind of race through the population and affect most of them and then sort of settle down? And then finally, is this something that unfortunately might become endemic in cattle? There is flu that infects pigs in Canada and the U.S. It jumped from birds decades ago, and we haven't been able to get rid of it. It's something that has an impact on production, and we try to vaccinate against. Is this something that is going to be an ongoing issue with cattle? And then finally, the big question is, are we going to see adaptations in the genomes of these viruses that are going to be particularly concerning? And we certainly need to be doing everything we can to see what's happening and whether there is spread of this within humans, which would be concerning.
Michael, as always, thanks for your expertise on this. I imagine we'll catch up in the not too distant future to find out where we're at, but thanks for your time tonight.
Anytime. Good to talk.
I always say to my colleagues when I meet other world leaders, I say, would you trade places with China? Would you trade places with their problems? They've got a population that is more people in retirement than working. They're not importing any. They're not bringing. They're xenophobic. Nobody coming else coming in. They've got real problems. I'm not looking for a fight with China. I'm looking for competition, but fair competition. In addition, we're standing up for peace and stability across the Taiwan Straits. I've revitalized our partnerships and our alliances in the Pacific with India, Australia, South Korea, the Philippines, and other Pacific Island nations. I made sure that we have the most advanced technologies that we've developed and invented, and they can't be sent to China or undermine our, because they'll undermine our national security. When I spoke with Xi Jinping, he said, why? I said, because you're using them for all the wrong reasons, so you're not going to get those advanced computer chips. Finally, for all this tough talk on China, it never occurred to my predecessor to do any of that. The bottom line is I want fair competition with China, not conflict. And we're in a stronger position to win the economic competition of the 21st century against China or anyone else because we're investing in America and American workers again.
There you have it. A fairly lengthy statement, but that's U.S. President Joe Biden, obviously, earlier this month, talking about the threat from China. He was at a campaign stop in Pennsylvania at the time. A threat that he has long said is far greater than that posed by other countries such as Russia and Iran. It's hard to argue that there is a major power conflict going on in this century, or at least in the first half, that won't shape the planet as much as the battle between Washington and Beijing. My next guest famously predicted, one of the few who did, that Vladimir Putin would launch a full-scale invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago now. And now he's turned his attention to that battle between China and the U.S. in a new book called World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. He argues that the two countries are already in the throes of what could be called a second Cold War, or at least that's how China is approaching it, as a competition. That's what he sees. And they stress obviously he stresses in the book that this Cold War is significantly different from the last one. Of course, on one element alone, it is fundamentally different in many ways, China's economic integration into the global economy being one of the major ones. And of course, a lot of the focus on this is on Taiwan, which remains that flashpoint. I mean, the last Cold War had Cuba, it had West Berlin or Berlin. This one feels like Taiwan could be the spot that could see this conflict go from cold to not so cold pretty quickly. Again, Dmitry Alperovich is the co-founder of CrowdStrike. He's the founder of Silverado Policy Accelerator in DC. And his new book is called World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. And Dmitry joins me now. Thanks for your time. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
This is a fascinating, I mean, this is a topic that we discuss a lot. Obviously, in the year of a presidential election, it's fascinating as well, because foreign policy won't probably come up that much, but it probably should. You've said essentially, and we've debated this here too, whether or not we're already in a new Cold War. Just because it doesn't look quite like the last one doesn't mean we're not in one.
Well, I actually believe that not only are we in a Cold War, and Cold War Roman numeral 2, as I call it, not 2.0, as some people refer to it, because it's not a continuation, of course, of the original one. But actually, my book lays out the great deal of similarities that we have between the first two conflicts. And when you actually step back and look at it, I was actually shocked in doing the research just how remarkably similar the situation is today versus what it was in the Soviet Union. Let me just run through a few of them. Mm-hmm. We unquestionably have a global competition for supremacy like we had during the first Cold War, now between China and America. We have arms races, both a conventional arms race with huge military buildups and a nuclear one, as both countries are modernizing their nuclear arsenals. And China is, of course, trying to build up a nuclear arsenal, going from about 300 nuclear warheads to over 1,000 by the end of the decade. We have a competition for military bases in the region. The United States is trying to build military bases once again in the Philippines, expand in Japan and Guam. China is doing the same in Pakistan and Cambodia, as well as far away as Djibouti. You have a trade war, an economic war that's going on. You have a spy war that actually eclipses anything the likes of which we saw during the Cold War, in part, of course, because of cyber. So on almost every aspect of what we saw during the first Cold War, and of course, we have a flashpoint, a regional flashpoint that can take the two powers into conflict. It was West Berlin during the first part of the Cold War, and it's now Taiwan. And the only sort of argument against the Cold War narrative is that you have this economic interdependence, mm-hmm. which certainly eclipses anything that we saw with the Soviet Union. But as I write in the book, even during the Soviet Union Cold War era, we had significant connections with the Soviet industry throughout the entire Cold War. And one of the most prominent examples of that was actually Western firms, including Canadian firms, selling technology to the Soviet Union throughout the 60s and 70s to operate their oil and gas industry that, of course, sustained the entire economy of the Soviet Union. So those connections were there even during the first Cold War. Of course, the magnitude is very different now.
When you look at the urgency of this too, I mean, the flashpoint often, and you just mentioned it, is Taiwan, right? We often think of if this could continue to be sort of a Cold War for, you know, years and years on end, if there wasn't some sort of flashpoint. And Taiwan always feels like it could be the flashpoint. And we last spoke, I think, over Ukraine. And of course, you had famously predicted that Putin would go in when so many were saying that he wouldn't. And you see some similarities here with Xi Jinping, not just in where China is sort of geopolitically, but also in the person themselves.
That's right. In fact, there were five reasons that convinced me why Putin was going to invade Ukraine months before it actually happened. And it's striking, but those exact five reasons apply to the situation in the Indo-Pacific. So first of all, what drove Putin to invade Ukraine, first and foremost, was his distorted view of history. He never thought that Ukraine was a nation. He always thought that it was his destiny and Russia's destiny to bring Ukraine back into Russian sphere of influence. Well, the same thing is playing out in the Indo-Pacific, where she has also a distorted view of history, that Taiwan always belonged to China. But as I write in the book, and we have a big section on the history of Taiwan and China, there's never been one moment in history, not one year, when whoever fully controlled China also fully controlled Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And he believes that it is his destiny, personal destiny, China's destiny to take Taiwan, of course, and something that he feels very urgently about because he wants it to happen on his watch. Just like with Putin, ego plays a huge role in the decision making of both men. Putin and Xi are both in their 70s now, so they're looking at their own mortality, their own sort of twilight of power. And Xi Jinping is very clear that he wants this to not be passed to future generations. That means probably the next 10 years or so are going to be potentially even less, because his term potentially would end in 2032 if he gets reelected in 27. So the next 4 to 8 years, I believe, are very, very dangerous that can drive him. But the other element of this that I think is underappreciated is both men are very focused on security and geography. So even though I'm not of the view that NATO expansion to the borders of Russia was the cause of the conflict, I also don't believe that it had absolutely nothing to do with it, as some people claim, because the reality is that Russia has always been concerned about NATO expansion to some degree. Again, it wasn't a singular decision point for Putin to invade, but it certainly played a role. And when he looked at Ukraine, he saw essentially a buffer state that would historically enable Russia to mobilize its troops when facing huge invasions from Europe, whether it's Hitler or Napoleon or the Poles or Teutonic Knights. And from a defensive perspective, he thought it was important to have Russia occupied, of course, completely illegal view, but nevertheless, that's how he thinks. But also from an offensive perspective, that if you want to project power into Europe, Ukraine is a critical territory for that. Well, Taiwan plays the same role in the Indo-Pacific. It is that anchor point of the first island chain that China looks at when it sees itself looking out at the Pacific. It is essentially right now fully contained by U.S. allies and military bases. All the way from the east, you have the Korean Peninsula with 28,000 American troops there and air bases and radar, to the Japanese island with the 7th Fleet and Marine on Okinawa, to Taiwan, an outpost of American power seen by China, and now to the Philippines, where America once again is building military bases. So breaking through and taking Taiwan would, A, from a defensive perspective, enable them to break out of this containment, but two, allow them to project power offensively across that entire region and essentially kick the U.S. out of Asia, a definite goal for China. So the similarities are really uncanny.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, just the legacy, too. I mean, Putin's is far more recent in terms of the humiliation of Russia post-Cold War, or at least post-fall of the Berlin Wall. But China, too, has long operated on this notion of humiliation, too, of retaking their rightful place, right? Oddly enough, you actually have sort of pinpointed a date, right, which I gather is November of 2028.
Well,
the book
starts out in the prologue with this fictional, but I think very realistic scenario of invasion that I set in November 13th, 2028. I do think that the window for invasion opens in 2028. I'm not predicting certainly the exact date. I don't think Xi Jinping has penciled it in on his calendar. It will be very much dependent on the circumstance, his own readiness. But 28, particularly the fall of 28, is really interesting, because that entire year is going to be very distracting for America and the world. First of all, you have the Taiwanese elections that can provide a casus belli for invasion, taking place in January with a new president getting inaugurated. In May of that year, you have the Olympics in Los Angeles. They're going to preoccupy most Americans throughout that whole summer. And then, of course, you have the elections in 2028, where, you know, it's very clear that whoever wins in November of this year will not be president in 2028. Joe Biden and President Trump, Donald Trump, would be term limited at that point. So you are going to have a new president one way or another getting elected, which could present an opportunity during transition from one administration to the other, potentially, for Xi Jinping to take advantage of. So I'm not predicting it will happen then, but the window opens, and I think it really closes in 2032, because it's unlikely at that point that Xi Jinping, who will be in his 79 at that point, will get yet another term.
Dmitry Alperovich is co-founder of CrowdStrike. He's founder of Silverado Policy Accelerator. His book is called World on the Brink: How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. We've been talking about Xi Jinping and the importance of Taiwan, the parallels between how China views Taiwan and how Russia views Ukraine. Dmitry, I guess one of the big issues here as we go forward now, we'll have a presidential election this year, and that could play a pretty important role in how China sees things unfold in the U.S. But clearly, Ukraine still remains an important piece of the puzzle when it comes to China and Taiwan.
You know, I actually think that's overstated. You know, a lot of people say that China is looking at what's happening in Ukraine. The reality is that Xi Jinping is going to make a decision to go based on his own reasons and his own capability and what he sees as a situation playing out in Asia. Whatever happens in Ukraine, win or lose, obviously we hope that Ukraine would win. I don't think it's going to affect that much of that calculus. Frankly, I think when China looks at that conflict today, it would be perfectly content with it playing out for as long as possible. It's keeping America distracted. America's spending its significant military arsenal in the aid to Ukraine. And of course, it benefits from Russia being weak because it's able to buy Russian gas and oil at enormous discounts. It's able to sell, including through black markets, various goods to Russia and corner the Russian market with Western firms pulling out. So I think this conflict suits Xi Jinping just fine.
Right. When you look at then the ability to then deter China, because I mean, this in many ways, your book is sort of raising the flag and saying, you know, we should be treating this with more urgency. You look into several different ways of doing it. One of them, of course, is standing by your allies. You do have a section, as you were mentioning in the book, on the two Michaels in Canada, for instance, as an example of what America could do differently in coming years to try to build up more of a united front against China.
Yeah, the book really is a grand strategy of how do we, A, deter the invasion of Taiwan, which I think is absolutely vital to U.S. interests, but also looking at the broader Cold War and how do we win. And you're absolutely right. I think we often do not stand by our allies, treat them sort of for granted. And the two Michaels is a perfect example where, of course, the cause of the two Michaels, these hostages that of Canadian citizens that they grabbed in China, were caused by the fact that we arrested the CFO of Huawei, the Canadians did, on behalf of the U.S. And then we basically let Canada hang out to dry in response without any coercion on China to release the two Michaels. We've done the same thing with Australia. We didn't stand by them when the Chinese were coercing them economically and not buying their barley and wine and lobsters. Mm-hmm. So we do need to do a lot more for our allies if we expect them to work with us in helping to contain the threat of China. And that's absolutely an important key part of the strategy. I propose something that is akin to an economic version of NATO for countries that would decide to join in, but it's not centered obviously on the Atlantic and not centered on the military dimension of the problem, but basically an alliance. I call it the Treaty of Allied Market Economies, or TAME, that countries could join and essentially would get an Article 5 type of one for all and all for one protection, right, where one country like Canada or Australia or others come under coercion from any state, authoritarian state out there, that there would be an economic response that would be proportional to the economic damage that you would suffer from the entire alliance, and obviously proportional to the economies of each member. And if the United States obviously is the organizing member, the bulk of the cost would be on us. But it would be one way to create a deterrent effect against the type of coercion we've seen from China, particularly in the economic sphere.
When you look at what we can do then between now and sort of as that window opens up in 2028, perhaps until the early 2030s, what do you think then the most vital is? Because I suppose what you want to do, and this can be tricky, as we've seen with Vladimir Putin, is try to get President Xi to weigh his options and then to decide that the option of going into Taiwan is not one that he can, that is not beneficial to him. How do you change his calculus then between now and then? As you mentioned, it's a difficult one because there are many different things at play, and a lot of them are very personal to him and unique to his situation.
Well, I think there are three major differences between Taiwan and Ukraine that play in our favor. The first one is that the stakes for Xi are incredibly high. Look, I've said this on many occasions, that Putin fundamentally can lose in Ukraine and still survive, right? Because his goals are very nebulous. Demilitarization, denazification, what does that even mean? I've argued that he can declare victory today, pull out, and he would survive just fine. Well, for Xi, it's a very binary outcome. If you're going to take Taiwan and you don't take it, the outcomes for him are quite dire. Very likely he will lose power. Potentially even the CCP could lose power in China. So if they're going to go, they better be certain that they can win, or the repercussions would be enormously severe. Second, Taiwan, unlike Ukraine, is a natural fortress. This would be one of the most complicated military operations in history. The island is literally littered with mountains, rivers, bridges, tunnels. From a logistical standpoint, coming across the Taiwan Strait is incredibly difficult. Half of the year, that strait is barely passable to anything but huge container ships. So very, very difficult operation to conduct for China. And three, we can have the benefit of time, which we didn't really have with Ukraine, right? You know, we realized, it may be in December or January that he's going for it. The war occurred in February. There was not enough time to deter. Here we have, I argue, at least 4 years, maybe as much as eight, to try to deter, to increase our leverage over China. And certainly there's a military dimension to the strategy, but also an economic dimension, an ally dimension, and a technology dimension. I argue that even aside from Taiwan, we absolutely have to win the race for the 21st century in the technology space, where the technologies like AI and autonomy, biotech and synthetic biology, space technology, and green tech, this new energy technology, we have to make sure that we and our friends and allies are dominating those fields. And the two components that go into them, the semiconductors, chips, and critical minerals, we also need to manufacture them.
You're right. Which, of course, at this point in time, the latter rests a lot with China and the former rests a lot with Taiwan, which of course, creates an even more complicated situation when it comes to, or creates even more urgency with trying to onshore or reshore those things.
Indeed. But, as I write in the book is actually very optimistic, despite right. the title, World on the Brink. It is a very dangerous world. But I argue that we and our allies have all the strengths. We have the biggest economy in the world. We have the greatest alliances, the greatest military, enormous leverage. This is incredibly difficult for China. But we have to mobilize our strengths. And the big question mark in the book is, do we have the political will to do so?
Right. I mean, and that has always been the issue, right? I mean, even when it comes to trade and protectionism and so on, a tame, as you've put it, it sounds like a great idea, but then you need to have political will to do it, right?
That's right. And, something like tame sounds like a great idea until people start thinking, well, if Canada comes under economic coercion from China, America would have to respond in kind and suffer potentially with, trade sanctions against our agricultural sector, whatever. Are we willing to do that? But again, we did this with NATO, where we committed to the defense of the NATO alliance, committing to lose American troops to do so. Well, I would hope that we would be willing to lose some of the money in our pocketbooks, certainly to help our allies as well.
Well, Dmitry, I'm sure the book's going to have a lot of people talking. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In New York tonight, all eyes have been on Columbia University. Police went in this evening to clear about 30 or 40 people. People have been arrested at the university's Hamilton Hall. And that's after pro-Palestinian protesters occupied the administration building in New York earlier in the day. NYPD officers acted after the school's president said there was no other way to ensure safety and restore order on campus. The occupied building had expanded the demonstrators' reach from an encampment that's been there for quite a while now on the grounds of the Ivy League school.
This is a special report from ABC News. Columbia protests cleared. I'm Daria Albinger. About four dozen students have been arrested as New York City police moved in tonight on the campus of Columbia University, where anti-war protests expanded to the occupation of Hamilton Hall, a building on campus. ABC's Aaron Katursky says officers moved in wearing riot gear.
They moved in with very heavy equipment. Officers carrying zip ties, knowing they would likely be making arrests, which they are doing. The goal here is to clear out the building that had been occupied, Hamilton Hall, and also to clear out the tented encampment.
Students who don't disperse could be expelled. Some of the protesters moved about 20 blocks north in Manhattan to the campus of City College. Columbia has asked the NYPD to maintain a presence on campus through May 17th, which is after the graduation ceremonies take place. This is ABC News.
There you have it. So that's the latest from New York City tonight. So not only have they gotten rid of the, moved out protesters who had taken over that building, they've also gotten rid of the encampment. And of course, the encampment at Columbia that followed a series of events that I won't go completely into has prompted others around North America, across the U.S. and also here at home. Pro-Palestinian protesters have set up an encampment at the University of British Columbia campus in Vancouver. They've been there for a bit. They're planning a protracted stay, apparently. One protester who spoke to the Canadian press today only identified himself as Kevin, says he and others in Vancouver are aware that a similar protest at McGill University in Montreal had prompted the school to ask that school to ask police to dismantle the camp there.
Universities are places of learning. They're places for freedom of expression, freedom of thought, freedom of ideas. But that only works if people feel safe on campus. Right now, right across the country, Jewish students do not feel safe. That's not right.
That indeed is the Prime Minister talking about. Today he was asked about the situation on university campuses in this country. Gabriel Miller is President and CEO of Universities Canada. They are an umbrella group for all the country's universities, and he speaks to me. He's with me tonight. Gabriel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is a broad question, of course, but just your initial reaction to what we've been seeing in terms of protests in Canada and just sort of the overriding reaction from the universities themselves, because this is clearly a delicate situation for all involved.
There's no question. It's a challenging time. It's a difficult time. These are sensitive issues, and a lot of people are struggling and have strong emotions. Canada's universities are responding in a way that's deeply consistent with their commitment to provide space on campus that's safe and respectful. And that's the dual priority here. And that means that we want to have spaces where people can talk about the most difficult, sometimes the most sensitive issues facing our society, but they have to do it in a way that respects the right of other people to safety, to go about their day-to-day lives without being harassed or discriminated against. And I think that's what our members have been striving for and doing their very best to achieve.
What are the rules? Because I think a lot of people out there wonder what the rules are. Universities are clearly, campuses are private property. Students obviously have a right to be on that property. But what is the rule around protests and the different variances of protests?
Sure. Well, this is a big country, so we have variations in different provinces and different communities. But there's two broad rules I think we could talk about. First of all, there's the law. And in Canada, we have laws against hate speech and hate crimes. And so that's, you know, a real base is that those laws must be respected. And if they aren't, then that's a matter that really has to be taken up with institutions and with law enforcement. And then the second is people have a right to not be harassed or bullied or intimidated. And often institutions will have a code of conduct or some other kind of policy that states that. And I think in addition to that, you're right that these campuses have rules governing the use of different space and procedures that people are expected to follow if they want to have an event or a protest. And people are expected to follow those rules.
When you look at the line, though, I think one of the difficulties here is that one person's free speech and even some of the political slogans that are used in this particular in these particular protests are seen differently by different people. So it becomes quite a difficult line to figure out in some sense. And I think that's what we're seeing, not just here, but obviously in the US as well, that it is, much of it is in the eye of the beholder. And that puts you and your members in a difficult situation.
There's no question that, there's some language that is debated, but I think most of us have a pretty good sense of what's clearly out of bounds. You know, anything that's openly racist or that's supporting, you know, violence or genocide against a people of any kind, that's clearly, against the spirit of Canadian law. And even if, you know, it doesn't meet the definition of hate speech, you know, I think it's pretty clear when people are saying things in a way that's designed to harass or intimidate or inspire fear in other people. Now, you can't take care of all of these problems through the enforcement of a rule. Some of this requires appealing to people's just basic sense of decency and their compassion for other folks and asking them to remember that if they want their right to express themselves, to be respected. They need to respect the right of other people to go about their lives without feeling like they're being targeted.
Right. And as you well know, of course, universities have long been spaces where these sorts of contentious issues can be hammered out between people who disagree vehemently. But they are, and have always been, areas where we expect people to tackle some of these more sensitive issues. So you don't want to come down too hard on either side, right?
Well, you definitely want to be building a space where difficult issues can be discussed openly and productively. And so I think it's important to remember that creating a safe, respectful space is actually very much in the interests of the mission of our universities and in the interests of free speech, because those are the conditions where free speech really flourishes, where people really feel like they can speak openly and they can do it without concern of threat or intimidation. And that means respecting everyone's free speech and their rights as individuals to feel respected and safe in the space where they live and they study and they work.
Have you had any indication? I don't know how closely you're in touch with your membership at this point. I imagine they're trying to learn from each other as this is happening. But have you had any indication of just what level of unsafe there is out there? Or has it been relatively peaceful so far? What are you hearing?
I won't characterize the situation on the ground. You know, we're in our office in Ottawa, and I think I really need to respect the fact that each of these situations is unique, and the people that really can characterize, you know, those kind of challenges are the ones who are closest by. I can tell you that our members, our universities across the country, are taking this very seriously. There's nothing that matters to them more than ensuring the safety of their students and their communities, and doing that in a way that's consistent with their values and the mission of the institutions is not easy, but it's really important. And they are in communication with each other. They're watching for lessons from other campuses, and they'll be working on this as long as there's an issue.
How about on the politicization of it? Because, of course, one of the issues that's unfolded in the U.S. is the politicization of this. We've seen bits and pieces of it in this country, but you're right there in Ottawa, obviously. What's your sense of how much people are staying out of the way and letting this unfold on university campuses according to the way the universities want to handle the situation?
When their issues are as prominent and as sensitive as these are, inevitably they will also show up in our politics on Parliament Hill. You know, I think I'm choosing to believe that people recognize the importance of the issues that are at play here, and the fact that universities have a public mission that they need to fulfill in as responsible way as possible, and that they're not going to go out of their way to use this for political advantage, but we'll understand that this is a moment where the country really needs to be supportive of the work that's being done to address these issues in a safe and respectful way.
Lastly, I mean, as people watch this, and it's amazing, of course, that the same people who might have been protesting when they were at the university 30, 40 years ago are the same ones who get really off-put by student protests sometimes now. But what would you like Canadians in general to think when they watch these unfold on campuses? Because I get the sense, you know, of course, there's a lot of bleed between here and the U.S. We're watching what's happening in New York, for instance, and then seeing what's happening here in Canada. What would you like to remind Canadians about what this all means in the grand scheme of things when it comes to university life, when it comes to the importance of both having safe spaces on campus, but also allowing this sort of exchange of ideas that's so primordial to universities across the country?
I think what I would ask Canadians to remember is that while the most extreme voices, the most extreme behavior will be what generates attention, the vast majority of students, of faculty, of community members, of families understand that there is a role for universities in creating places where learning and discussion about these issues can take place, and that the vast majority of university leaders are doing everything they can to navigate a very challenging situation in a way that protects the university's mission while putting the safety of the folks on campus right at the top of their agenda.
Well, Gabriel, thank you.
Thank you, Ben.